This time on your weekly Constitutional, a new comprehensive biography of James Madison.
It's called The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. And it tells the whole story of Madison's life from soup to nuts. And the main focus of the book is the big changes that went on in the course of his own lifetime, in his beliefs and in the country.
That was Professor Noah Feldman of Harvard Law School, who was the featured speaker at Montpelier's celebration of President's Day. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about the three lives of James Madison.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
You know, I've learned something over the past 20 years or so, and that is that when you're speaking to people who are at the very top of their profession, I mean, the very best people, they tend actually to be rather humble and indeed rather nice. And my theory is that it's because they got to the tops of their profession, not out of ambition or ego, but because they really and truly love what they do. And most of the time, they're eager to share it. Well, such was the case with my recent meeting with a fellow I've long admired. His name is Noah Feldman, and he is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. And recently, he was out at Montpelier for President's Day to give the keynote address, talking all about his new biography of James Madison. I met Noah just before he gave his presentation. He was immediately among the most gracious and polite people I've met, and I even had the bonus of meeting his two children, Mina and Jamin, youngsters, just barely out of grade school, and they were equally polite and pleasant. It was a wonderful time. We went over to Kat Imhoff's house with her husband, Jeep, and we had a wonderful dinner before a blazing fireplace and stimulating conversation. And I was so impressed with both Noah and his kids that I invited them to come with us to the interview in the booth at the Potter Family Studios at Claude Moore Hall at Montpelier. And one of them, Jamin, the boy, accepted my invitation. So here it is, the first father-son interview in the history of this radio show.
My name is Noah Feldman, and I teach constitutional law and a little bit of international law. And I'm also someone who works a lot and cares a lot about designing constitutional institutions from scratch.
And you are far too modest. You teach at a place most people have probably heard of. I believe it's called, what was that place up in Boston?
It's called the Harvard Law School, and don't forget the definite article or, you know, you get into a lot of trouble.
I imagine you would. You also have a very distinguished background, including a Rhodes Scholarship. Congratulations.
Well, if it's still possible to accept congratulations for something that happened 25 years ago, I'm grateful to accept it. Thank you.
I'm still impressed by it. Let's just say that I am. And there is a young person here with you who looks kind of like you. Who is this person?
My name is Jim Feldman. I'm his son.
Tremendous. Jamin, how old are you?
I'm 12 years old.
12 years old. People can't see you, but I must say you look closer to 16 than to 12. You're almost as tall as your father now, and just about as well-spoken, I might add. We had a very pleasant dinner last night, and you have a remarkably polite couple of children.
Thank you very much for saying so.
Absolutely. Okay. Our subject today is your newest book, which just coincidentally happens to be about James Madison. Why don't you tell us about it?
It's called The Three Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President. And it tells the whole story of Madison's life from soup to nuts. And the main focus of the book is the big changes that went on in the course of his own lifetime, in his beliefs and in the country. And so the three lives are broken into a description of how he created the Constitution using really unmatched genius. And most of us think that that's the main thing we know about James Madison. It's the main thing we care about. But he wasn't done. After that, when he went into the government that he had helped create, he became the leader with Thomas Jefferson of the first political party in the United States, the Old Republican Party, which went to war with the Federalist Party, which was championed by none other than Alexander Hamilton. And they, who had been close friends, Hamilton and Madison, became bitter enemies. And that's the story of Madison's second life. And the third life has to do with the moment when Jefferson and Madison, as the Secretary of State, actually took over the government. and became president and secretary of state, respectively. And they started to try to run U.S. foreign policy. And Madison did that for 8 years, and then he was president of the United States for 8 years. And in this third life, he became the first president to take the United States into a real declared war, the War of 1812, which turned out to be dramatic and almost disastrous. But they managed to survive that war by stroke of luck. And ultimately, Madison went down in the history books as a tremendously successful president, at least in his era. Later historians have been more skeptical about whether Madison was actually a great, great president, and I talk a lot about that in the book, too.
Well, we have a very strong opinion on that subject here. But I'm sure you've reached your own. Let's take them in order, then. Let's talk about the first phase of Madison's life.
Madison was not a typical politician. He hated crowds. He didn't like running for office. He was not someone you would have wanted to sit down and have a beer with. And the proof of that is when he first tried to run for state legislature, he actually refused to follow the local custom, which involved buying beer and hard liquor for all of the people who were showing up to vote. And his opponent was a guy who ran a tavern, and what do you know, he won, and won easily. Madison was not a natural sort of man of the people politician. He was short. He had a speaking voice that was worth listening to if you could hear him. But in the days before amplification, he was hard to hear.
Right.
Nevertheless, he became this tremendously important, and in some ways the most important, of the founding fathers. And the first part of the book tells the story of how in the world that could have happened. And ultimately, the way it happened is that in a moment of revolution, when you've thrown off the old bonds, you then have to ask yourself, what now? What are we going to do? And the skills that make you George Washington, a great general, a great leader, are not the same skills that allow you to answer the question, what do we do now? And ultimately, it was Madison of the founders who had the best ability to dig deep into history, to dig deep into politics, and come up with new ideas and new solutions, most prominent of which was the idea of a federal constitution. Madison had a very idealistic young man's view of what the Constitution could do. He thought he had solved some of the basic fundamental problems of politics in the way that Isaac Newton had solved some of the basic fundamental problems of physics. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that high theory was great when it came to designing a constitution, not so easy when it came to getting it adopted and ratified. And so Madison began to make changes and compromises already in the ratification process.
Before we get there, though, we are at Montpelier. And, of course, the second floor library, which I sometimes refer to as the womb of the Constitution, where it was conceived. That's a story in and of itself. So let's, before we leave the genius part, before we get to the practical politician part, let's talk about exactly how Madison addressed himself to the question, the great question of how to design a federal system of government.
Amazingly enough, the answer is books.
What a concept.
There are very few questions in life that the true answer is books, but in this instance, that really was the case. Mm-hmm. He thought that what he needed to do was understand better than any other person had ever understood the history of every country in the world that had tried to be a confederation, that had tried to take something like our 13 colonies, which had become states, and bring them together. And so he looked at ancient history, because the Greeks and the Romans had examples, mm-hmm. and he looked at modern history, modern European history. And in order to get these books, which were not available in the United States, he actually took advantage of his relationship with Jefferson, who was in France as ambassador, and he asked him to send him books, and he also asked for permission to use Jefferson's more extensive library at Monticello, and he did both of those things. And then he locked himself in that study in Montpelier, a place that then, as now, was a little distant from the hustle and bustle of the rest of the world, and he just made extensive notes, tried to figure out and tried to identify what he thought were the vices or the drawbacks of those confederations, and then as he found problems, he tried to find solutions. And for him, the central problem, the thing that worried him the most, was that confederations tended to fly apart. All the different members had their own interests, they fought with each other, they had no central authority typically that can control them. And so Madison came up with the insight that what was needed was to maintain the independence to some degree of those member states while simultaneously creating a central authority, sort of like the sun in the Newtonian picture of the solar system, mm-hmm. with a gravitational force to hold them together and keep them in orbit.
Now, was this the first instance of a federal concept being put into a constitution? I mean, that's the definition of a federal government, is you've got two levels of government covering the same geographical area, in our case, the state and then the national, always in tension. Was this the first instance of that, or was there a specific example that he was following?
It was the first time that anyone had tried what we think of as modern federalism. And what made that different and unique and original to Madison is that instead of the central government just telling the states what to do, the central government actually would tell individuals what to do. So ordinary people would be governed by two different kinds of government, two different kinds of sovereigns: state governments, which would manage local affairs, and a federal government, which would manage national affairs. And that was a total innovation. In fact, before then, people thought it was logically impossible to have two sovereigns at the same time. They even had a nickname for it. You know, they said it was a sovereign within a sovereign, or in fancy Latin, imperium in imperio, and they said that was illogical. You couldn't do that, and it would never work.
Well, and that was the example they had, or I should say the opposite. They had the Articles of Confederation, which had some kind of central government, but it only dealt with the state governments, who then in turn dealt with their own citizens. And so that was the standard prior to this, and so that really was an innovation. I think even today, sometimes people forget, and I will tell my students this periodically, just think of where you are right now. You're in the city of Knoxville in the state of Tennessee. You obviously have to obey the local and state laws, and if you don't, some fellow in a sheriff's uniform may come in and arrest you. But simultaneously, you have to obey all the national laws, and if you don't, some fellow in a DEA outfit or an FBI agent will come in and do that as well. And that is something that we take for granted, but it was a major innovation back in 1787.
Absolutely, and it's something that lots of countries in the world subsequently adopted, although, of course, not all countries. Mm-hmm. If you're in France, the cops will be wearing the same outfit when they come and arrest you. There's no distinction, really, between the laws that are enforced by national or local police forces, and there's no real distinction between those forces. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of countries in the world, including big democracies, India is a great example, you know, the world's largest democracy, that is a federalist system, very much like the U.S. system, and really it is Madison who truly invented that.
Remarkable. Okay, so the big danger is that we fly apart. The solution is a strong or energetic central government.
Yep.
And similarly, division of power. Now, that wasn't Madison's idea, the separation of powers, but he certainly insisted upon that, didn't he?
Absolutely. The idea of separation of powers was definitely out there. They liked to trace it back to ancient Greece, and whether that was literally the case or just metaphorically the case, they thought that there was a good example in Britain of a system that had a division of powers to some degree, but it wasn't formalized. And what the U.S. Constitution did was formalize that and make it into an express principle with Article 1, Congress, Article 2, the President, Article 3, the Judiciary, all thought to be meaningful and distinct. And in theory, when Madison left the Constitutional Convention and when the people ratified the Constitution, he believed they had found an optimal balance between all of these different elements, state and federal, and the different branches of government. And then it all came crashing down.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the beginning of Madison's second life, and it's a story of the move from innocence to hard-nosed real-world experience, and it starts with that extraordinary figure, Alexander Hamilton, who was not terribly engaged at the Constitutional Convention. He gave one speech where he actually said that only British-style monarchy could work in the United States.
So what, 6 hours long?
6 hours long. And afterwards, when no one was very interested, he left the convention and didn't come back for a month and a half. He got very involved with the Constitution when ratification came around, and he and Madison developed a very close friendship during ratification because they were co-authoring the Federalist Papers, where they were literally, one would begin a sentence and the other one would end it. So they became really close friends. And at that point, Madison didn't see any daylight between them. But the moment that Madison realized that Hamilton, as Secretary of Treasury, had different plans for the country, the relationship slowly began to fray. The key to those plans, Hamilton was very clear about this, was to create a bond market, a financial market, which we did not have in the United States, and to use that bond market to exercise central leverage over the government so that the financial markets would have more power over the government than the people. And Hamilton did not, he was not the kind of person who liked to hide the ball.
Right.
He told us straight out, we need a national deficit that he said would become a national debt that he said would be quote-unquote immortal, so it would never go away, so the bond markets would always be happy. And he wanted a national bank whose goal it was to keep this financial market happy. And then he wanted the United States government to start promoting industrialization on the British model and move away from the agricultural economy that had still dominated to a great extent at the time.
Now, that's a confusing concept. I mean, Hamilton was a genius, too.
He
was a financial genius, certainly. This assumption of debt. Let's go over that a little bit more, because that's counterintuitive for most people. Why in the world would this new national government wish to encumber itself with the existing debts that had been incurred by the state governments for the Revolutionary War? Why would they want to do that?
Great question. And the reason is you have to begin with the assumption they had, which was that the new national government didn't have the capacity to do anything. The Articles of Confederation had had a Congress with no power to do anything because it had no money.
Right.
If you want to do something, you need money. So then the question is, where do you get money from? Well, the answer is you need taxes. But taxes are unpopular. Our forefathers, God bless them, were obsessed with taxes. Maybe we still are. They were paranoid on the subject of taxes. Remember, they made a revolution because of a little tax on some pieces of paper. I mean, they were not rational on the subject. So Hamilton thought to himself, how do I get the central government to raise taxes? And there's a backwards but brilliant answer. If you owe money, you need the money to come from somewhere in order to pay it back. So by assuming the debts not only that the United States had owed to its own soldiers and to suppliers, but also assuming the debts that the states had owed to the soldiers that they had used during the Revolutionary War, the federal government would start out life deeply, deeply in debt, and that would force it to raise taxes. And once it got in the habit of raising taxes, people would get in the habit of paying those taxes. Once it was doing that, there would be a financial market that was accustomed to borrowing and lending money, and they would pressure the government to keep on borrowing money and keep on raising taxes, and now the government would have a budget.
The government
would have a
budget,
it could do stuff.
Precisely. In fact, I think this is a really fundamental question, and it goes to the question of what exactly is money. And there are many different definitions of it. It's a medium of exchange. It's something that's a store of wealth, a way of keeping score, if you prefer. Mm-hmm. But I think my favorite definition, especially in the political context, is that money is power. And if you get a situation, if you create a situation where money flows in to the national government and flows out of the national government, then whoever is controlling that flow is controlling not only the economy, but much of the politics of the country. And that was the essential insight that Hamilton had. And Madison didn't like it.
He did not. Madison thought we just created a government of the people. The Constitution began with the words, we the people. Now power is going to lie with we the bond markets.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week I'm speaking with Noah Feldman, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, all about his new book, The Three Lives of James Madison. And we'll even have a special guest. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Noah Feldman, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. The Harvard Law School. Before the break, we were talking about something that existed back in the day as well as it does today. That is that politics can sever friendships, and it can lead even good people to say very nasty things about their opponents, even, oh my goodness, James Madison.
He developed a practice that was actually just as original as his constitutional practice in the first place. Namely, he started saying that his opponent was not just wrong, not just badly motivated, but was actually trying to break the Constitution itself.
Oh, my.
And so Madison inaugurated a practice we're still very familiar with today, where when we don't like something that the other party is doing, we say they're breaking the Constitution. And in our moment, I think you can all recognize that no matter which party you like, people on both sides are saying that the other party is subverting the Constitution in a fundamental way. That's a very brutal way to talk, but Madison was a major, major figure in inventing it, and he believed it. He believed that the National Bank was not authorized anywhere in the Constitution. After all, he'd been there, he wrote it. He was sure Congress, in its limited set of powers, had no power to incorporate a national bank. And he began to denounce Hamilton, created a political party to do it, and along the way, he lost his very close relationship with George Washington, whom Madison had been a friend of, close with, to the extent anyone could be friends with a great man. And eventually they fell out because Madison just kept on pushing this line that Washington and the Federalist Party were potentially violating the Constitution.
You're disillusioning me right and left, because now you've told me that debt and vicious, even vile political rhetoric is as American as apple pie. And then it goes all the way back to the beginning.
It's more American than apple pie. I'm not sure we had that much apple pie at the time. It's as American as good whiskey. How about that?
Yes, indeed. Indeed, that was the basis of Hamilton's first big tax, was whiskey. And that was, of course, the basis of some of George Washington's wealth.
And what's more, people didn't like it. And the so-called Whiskey Rebellion, which was a serious tax rebellion, by Americans primarily in Pennsylvania and into Ohio was an occasion for the Federalists, with Washington all the way behind them, to raise an army, several thousand strong, and march out federal power towards the places where people weren't paying their taxes. Mm-hmm. Hamilton was right there with the army, and it was deeply partisan. It was, you know, it's like an episode of Homeland. You know, there were the U.S. troops, and there were the tax resistors face to face, and Republicans were with the protesters, and Federalists were with the army. So that's the way it was.
It's just remarkable. And as you say, those same arguments are being had today. You'll often hear this, the small government people, which mostly these days inhabit the modern Republican Party, which we should emphasize again is completely distinct, founded 100 years later, or 67 or whatever it was. But the very idea is that, you know, we don't want the central government taking our taxes and then doling them back out to us, because, of course, when they do that, money is power, and permission or whatever from the central government it must be had. People still don't like that to this day. I often had thought, before I understood the things that you're talking about a little bit better, that Madison's sudden shift away from his genius phase into his practical politician phase, or his anti-federalist phase, if you prefer, happened suddenly when Thomas Jefferson came back from France. And I had this vision of Jefferson stepping off the boat and looking at him and saying, "Jemmy, what the hell have you done?" But it's nothing that dramatic, is it? It was much more of an evolution once Madison saw what was happening in Washington's cabinet.
It was as dramatic as that, but it wasn't down to Jefferson.
Right.
It was down to the realization that Hamilton had played him. Mm-hmm. That Hamilton had been fully on board to create a government so that it could do a whole set of things that Hamilton thought were essential and Madison thought were the end of the world. And so for Madison, it was a relief that Jefferson came back, because now he had a political ally whom he could use to start fighting the fight against the Federalists. Mm-hmm. And they did indeed fight alongside each other, with Jefferson providing the pizzazz and Madison doing the heavy lifting, you know, the hard work of political organizing.
Right.
And then ultimately, this led to the election of 1800, mm-hmm. which, if you won, which the Republicans did, you called the Revolution of 1800. And as far as they were concerned, they had really destroyed the Federalist Party forever, and a good thing, too. They thought that political parties were inherently a bad idea. I mean, one of Madison's key constitutional design components was supposed to be that we wouldn't need political parties, because we'd have the separation of powers and that would manage it without political parties. And so the only justification for having a party was to destroy the other party forever. And they thought that's what they had done in 1800, and certainly they managed to get rid of Hamilton, who, in fact, was done from the political world. And then it turned out running things wasn't that easy either. Mm-hmm. It turned out that running the country, which Madison and Jefferson did for a total of 16 years between them, involved new challenges that were just as hard as the challenges they had been facing when they were in opposition.
Before we leave the Hamiltonian debate, how could Madison have not realized? I mean, he was the primary author of the Constitution, and the powers in Article I, collecting taxes, the spending powers, they were right there in Article I. How could he not have realized that the national government might very well do exactly what, I mean, to borrow money is right there in Article I. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't he realize that that was something that was bound to happen at some point?
Combination of two answers. One, reading the practical politics, he thought there was no national constituency who would want to pay more taxes.
So even though he was granting a power, he figured it would be used sparingly?
Exactly, because he thought that, and this is the second part of the answer, he perceived, as it turned out incorrectly, that there would be no mechanism urging the United States government to raise more and more and more taxes. And this was deeply naive on his part, because he didn't think of the financial markets having interests, because the financial markets were totally underdeveloped in the United States. And that's what Hamilton saw. So Hamilton wanted to create an interest group that would ask for taxes. And the entity that would ask for taxes would be the bond markets, because if you've borrowed money, like the United States government had done from somebody, that somebody has one goal and one goal only: make you raise enough taxes to pay them back.
Right, with interest.
And Madison just didn't see it coming. And, you know, we're here in Montpelier. We can see where Madison made his living, such as it was, mm-hmm. and that was in agriculture. He was running a large plantation with well over 100 enslaved African Americans as mm-hmm. his labor. He never made very much money on the plantation, But in the end, that was very far from the trading houses of London or of Amsterdam, which were the model that Hamilton had in his mind. And he wanted to make sure that we had our own financial institutions that operated just like the European ones. It's the difference between being brought up in wealth, slavery-driven wealth, to be sure, but sure. wealth and agriculture. And on the other hand, being a penniless orphan who learned to trade just to stay alive from an early age.
Right. That was Hamilton's first job, was in a trading house, yes, down in the islands. Fascinating stuff, and you've explained it so well that and before we leave this, just one more thing that from the modern era. You recall during the late 1990s when we actually were at the point where we were paying down the national debt significantly, one of the most surprising things I heard during that time was people being concerned that we would pay it off. Mm-hmm. Because that would, of course, eliminate what is the gold standard for the bond market, and that's U.S. Treasury bonds.
Yep.
Those are valuable things, those debt instruments. And all those years ago, Hamilton recognized that, and all those years ago, Madison failed to recognize it. That is just extraordinary. Okay, so the last phase then, governance.
Governance, not that easy for the following reason. The biggest problem facing the United States throughout the first, say, 25 years of its existence was how could we force Great Britain to let the United States and its ships trade in the places where we used to trade when we were part of Great Britain. So the key to this is to see that the British Empire worked kind of like a trade union, like the European Union. To be part of the empire was to be able to trade with all the British Empire's ports. Well, when we made a revolution in 1776, it was sort of a little mini Brexit. We walked away. British response was to say, you can't trade in our ports. And so what could a tiny country like the United States at the periphery of the empire with six ships to Britain's roughly 700 ships without a standing army, because the founders, including Madison, believed a standing army would be the death of a republic, what could a little country like this do to force Britain and then eventually France, which got on board and also banned our shipping, to let our ships trade? And this was always a problem, but it got worse when the Napoleonic Wars started. Because now the British and the French were fighting what was essentially a global war, and increasingly, American ships couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't go anywhere in Europe because Napoleon controlled Europe. They couldn't go to Britain or to the West Indies because those are the places where Britain was in control. And Madison and Jefferson's solution was trade sanctions. They thought that by limiting trade, they could force the opening of trade. And they tried every possible configuration of this. And mostly it didn't go well. So famously, at the end of Jefferson's presidency, Madison came up with the idea of an embargo. The United States would simply say to Britain, we refuse to sell you any goods.
Britain didn't care.
It wasn't that they didn't care at all. They did actually, it did matter to them to some degree. Uh-huh. Prices went way up for crucial American things, including mm-hmm. grain and cotton. Mm-hmm. But Britain got through it. They right. used Canada as a source. They found some new markets. They managed.
Right.
Because the problem with an embargo is, you know, it's a game of chicken.
Right.
I'm going to go broke if I don't sell you my products. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we lost the game of chicken.
Again, this just strikes me as great naivete on part of both Jefferson and Madison. They didn't understand their relative strength as trading partners.
It was naive, but interestingly, it almost worked mm-hmm. because as they got better and better at using the trade sanctions in Madison's first term as president, so between 1809 and 1812, they actually managed to push the British by playing them off against the French to the point where very fatefully, in June of 1812, the British government actually voted in Parliament to stop interfering with U.S. shipping and to allow the U.S. to trade. And the extraordinary tragedy and drama of the War of 1812 is that when that vote happened in Parliament, Madison had already gone to the U.S. Congress that same week.
Oh, dear.
And asked Congress to declare war on Britain in order to add weight to our threat. In other words, in order to move from trade sanctions alone to the good old-fashioned tool of going to war.
So we were on the verge of getting what we wanted when we decided to play our last card and go to war.
It's worse. We had gotten what we wanted, and we wouldn't know it for another 4 weeks.
Oh, no.
And that actually posed, I think, an existential problem in Madison's entire career in life. And it's one that my son and I don't see eye to eye about. And that question was, what should Madison have done when he then found out, several weeks into the war, with his first invasion of Canada being planned, that, in fact, he had gotten what he wanted, and the war was unnecessary. So let me start with historical record. He decided to go to war anyway. He had had Congress declare war. He was raising militias in order to go invade Canada. And he seems to have thought that it would look too bad and be too much of a mistake if, having declared war for the first time, the United States said, oh, never mind.
Golly, that, again, that seems to me to be a very questionable decision on Madison's part. But I don't want to anticipate your disagreement here. So what's your opinion on this, Jamin?
So the decision that James Madison made was obviously horrible, because people were dying as a result of his pride. And so, you know, as someone that, you know, created a country, he wanted to feel that he had the sort of power over other countries that he could actually go to war with Britain, this massive power, which he obviously couldn't really. And, you know, his hope sort of when starting the war was just that he could kind of, you know, get out of it with a minimal amount of damage done. But at the same time, people were still dying as a result of his pride.
So, Dad, you're just wrong. Well, what's your position on this before we tell you how wrong you are?
Well, I think seeing it from the perspective of a real-world president who had staked his whole reputation on asking Congress to declare war, this is someone who had never believed in war before. I can understand why, having gone so far down that line of the decision tree, he didn't think he needed to turn it around. Plus, he thought that the invasion of Canada would be quick and easy, that it would lead the British to make even more concessions than they had already made, and that it would establish the United States as a country to be reckoned with. But I agree, there was a fundamental miscalculation. It was all based on the idea that invading Canada would be easy. And in fact, as it turned out, invading Canada was something we failed to do twice, with two tries. Tried in 1812, tried again in 1813, struck out both times. And actually for an interesting reason. It turns out that relying on militias is a great way to defend your country when you're being invaded, and it's a terrible way to invade another country. And right at the Niagara River, thousands of militia from New York and elsewhere refused to cross the river, just flat out refused to take orders, claiming occasionally that there was no constitutional right to bring them into a position of offense. And Madison said, I wrote the Constitution, and that's ridiculous. That's not in the Constitution. But they said it anyway. And a lot of people did die. I mean, I think, you know, Jamin, you're right about that. And it is true that one of the things that happens when a president takes the country into war is that a lot of people on all sides end up dying. I think if you'd asked Madison, he would have said, it's not my pride, it's my desire to establish my country as one that you can't mess with. But
I guess I understand that. But I'm wondering if the simple fact that communications were slow in that day would have given Madison the ability to climb down from the cliff, to back off from the brink. If I were in Congress and he'd convinced me to vote for war, and then all of a sudden news came that, hey, we've gotten 85% of what we wanted, we just found out about it, so let's everybody hold off. I don't think I would have held that against Madison. I don't think it would have necessarily hurt his political career. And that must have been part of his calculation.
I think you're right. You know, he was in the process of running for re-election in 1812, so that's another element of it. I also think that in order to get Congress to declare war, he'd had to really stir up some anger. So take an issue that was not actually part of the real motivation to go to war, but he'd made central. This was the idea of impressment, the idea that the British Navy would stop American ships, not naval ships, but ordinary ships, and would force people to become British sailors. Now, the reality is that most of the people they were doing this to were actually British subjects, and sometimes were even actually people who had been in the Royal Navy and had deserted and were being re-brought in. But Madison made this into a huge issue because it had more popular weight than saying, trade, this is a war about trade. Another thing is that around the edges of the country, people badly wanted to expand. So, you know, ordinary Americans wanted to expand southwards towards Spanish possessions. They wanted to go, you know, northward towards British possessions. And those people were also on board for the war, and they weren't going to get what they wanted if we didn't go to war at all.
So this is just a war of conquest, then?
It had a big war of conquest element to it, no doubt about it.
That's certainly the way the Canadians feel about it. Every time I've talked to somebody from Canada and the subject's come up, they say, that's when you tried to take us over. And I think that there was some sentiment in this country that we were liberating Canadians from their overlords in Britain, and the Canadians rather strongly disagreed with that.
Yeah, we talked that talk.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're having a treat. We're having our first father-son interview, and indeed it's a father-son debate over what James Madison should have done at the outset of the War of 1812. After the break, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Noah Feldman, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at the Harvard Law School, and his son, Jamin. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Noah Feldman of Harvard Law School, who was the speaker at the recent President's Day celebration at Montpelier, where I had the pleasure of meeting not only him, but his lovely daughter, Mina, and his son, Jamin, 12 years old, who joined us in the broadcast booth and who has decidedly different views from his father's over whether James Madison should have prosecuted the War of 1812 after learning that the British had pretty much given us everything we wanted already. Well, Jamin, your dad hasn't convinced you then that this was the right thing for Madison to do?
It certainly hasn't convinced me, given that, you know, imagine that your family member dies in a war, and then a week later you find out, oh, wait, this war is completely pointless. My family member has just died.
Yeah. Well, and I'm struck by the fact that you're not that far from military age yourself, and perhaps you're looking at this a little differently than old guys like your dad and me. And I think perhaps that perspective is a valid one. And what really strikes me again is how many modern analogs there are. The belief that victory will be quick and easy, the belief that war must be fought if only to show the rest of the world that we're a force to be reckoned with. The last time I remember that being voiced was, what, about 10, 15 years ago, prior to the invasion of Iraq, which, again, was based upon a fallacy, many different fallacies, and has led to all sorts of problems. Seems we keep making the same mistakes again. Aren't you going to fix that, Jamin? I mean, come on, it's people of your generation. You got to fix that.
I think that it's just important to look at issues and, you know, sort of like weigh what good can come out of things and what bad can come out of things. And I certainly think that in James Madison's case, you know, he overweighed the value of, like, you know, American pride rather than the value of, you know, people.
Okay. What a concept. All right. Anything else about this last phase of Madison's life, past the War of 1812?
Well, I just think the significant question, of course, is how did Madison leave office so popular when, in the end, the War of 1812 was fought more or less to a standstill? And the answer is actually that the war went so badly. Eventually, Washington, D.C. got burned by the British.
You know, I have to interrupt you there.
Yeah.
I always heard when I was about Jamin's age, well, the War of 1812 was a draw. Any war where your enemy marches into your capital and burns it to the ground, I think you have to put that on the loss side.
Well, certainly symbolically, it was a tremendous loss. But, you know, Washington, D.C., certainly then, maybe it's still true now, it had symbolic value, but it didn't have strategic value. And what really mattered strategically was Baltimore. Because just a couple of weeks after the burning of Washington, D.C., the British tried to take Baltimore, and they tried to take it from the sea and with a landing of Marines. And this was the climactic battle that was actually witnessed by Francis Scott Key and immortalized in the poem that became our, you know, our national anthem. And that was actually a tremendously dramatic moment. All that business about the rocket's red glare was the moment at which, had Baltimore fallen, had the flag come down, then the United States might actually have ceased to be an independent country. But, and this is really extraordinary, Baltimore held out. The flag that continued to fly was the flag that signified that the U.S. had resisted the British invasion of Baltimore. Had the British taken Baltimore, we would have had no major port on the Chesapeake River Valley that would have enabled us to ultimately export produce. And so after that, the British rethought their position and decided to stop trying to invade the United States. And that felt like a victory to Americans. They had sort of been tried and tested, and there was a real possibility for a moment that we might actually lose our independence. And so then not losing your independence starts to look like maybe not a pure victory, but like a draw. And that's why the draw narrative came in. And then Andrew Jackson won a huge victory at New Orleans. And so that made us feel like it was actually a draw. And the upshot was Madison left office more popular than any president had ever been before him, and extraordinarily. And people started calling him the father of the Constitution, and the more positive aspect of his public image really, really kicked in.
He was the only president to have actually led American troops in battle as president.
That's true. It was a bit of an ignominious battle. But
yes.
At the Battle of Bladensburg, he went out with the troops, with the militia, to meet British regulars fresh from the war in Spain, which was the same war that Goya, you know, drew and painted his famous Horrors and Disasters of War series. It was a really brutal war in which burning down capital cities was the kind of thing you did. And the militia stood there, and the British charged, and then the militia turned and ran. Battle took less than 2 hours. But Madison didn't shrink from it. He was out there on the battlefield.
It was indeed. A remarkable, remarkable fellow. But he's not the only thing you've ever written about, the only figure you've ever written about, and you have very graciously agreed to talk to me about an earlier book of yours I read close to 10 years ago now, and one that I enjoyed so much that if I'd started this radio show a year or two earlier, or if you'd published this other book a year or two later, we probably would have talked about it. It's called Scorpions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I loved writing that book. It was tremendously fun. That is a book about four great Supreme Court justices, all of whom start their life as liberals and are appointed to the court by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So Felix Frankfurter, who was probably the single most prominent liberal law professor in the United States and then became a Supreme Court justice, an immigrant to the United States, came as a 12-year-old, a boy genius, invented the idea of judicial restraint, and lived a fascinating and controversial career in which he went from being the leading liberal in the country to being seen as a leading judicial conservative, all in the course of his career. Hugo Black, a boy raised in the backwater of Alabama, who was thrown out of high school, failed his first year of medical school, ended up as a lawyer, was a great trial lawyer, joined the Ku Klux Klan in order to become a senator, conveniently semi-resigned his Klan membership once he became a senator, was identified as the most radical man in the U.S. Senate during the Depression, and was put on the Supreme Court by Roosevelt. And in an extraordinary course of events, in those days, there were often no hearings at all when someone was nominated for the Supreme Court. There were no hearings on Black. He was nominated on a Friday. He was confirmed on a Wednesday. And by the end of the week, it had come out that he had been a Ku Klux Klan member. Caused a huge national scandal, and Black had to go on the national radio, which was a new thing at the time, and he said there that he was no longer a Klan member. Didn't say he never had been. He said that some of his best friends were Jews and Catholics, and some of his friends were African American. That's the exact formulation. Mm. And somehow he managed to survive the scandal, and then remarkably, he turned out to become a key advocate of desegregation on the Supreme Court. And when Brown against Board of Education was first argued in the fall of 1952, he was the only one of the justices from the segregated South who was prepared fully to go forward with integration and with putting an end to segregation. So an extraordinary legacy in his own right. He went on to invent the modern idea of originalism. Mm-hmm. But for him, unlike for Justice Scalia, originalism was primarily a liberal position rather than a conservative one.
As indeed was Frankfurter's idea of judicial restraint.
Absolutely. Judicial restraint was invented as a liberal position.
Because the court had been so conservatively active in the past.
Exactly.
All right. Well, who are the other two?
And so the other two are also equally fascinating. One is Robert Jackson, who was the last Supreme Court justice not to graduate from law school. He did 1 year at the Albany Law School, but in those days you could become a member of the bar by becoming essentially an intern in a law office for 2 more years, which is what he did in his uncle's law office. And he became a successful local attorney in upstate New York, knew Roosevelt peripherally from New York state politics, then ended up going to Washington during the New Deal, where he made his reputation by prosecuting Andrew Mellon, who had been Secretary of the Treasury and was one of the richest people in the country, for essentially tax fraud. In the course of that, Mellon decided to create a cover for himself by donating his collection of art to the newly created National Gallery in Washington. While he was at it, he threw in the building. He agreed to build the building.
It's nice to be rich.
Roosevelt would refer to the museum as to Jackson. He would say, the National Gallery is your museum. And this is what got Jackson famous. And he then subsequently became Solicitor General of the United States, won 28, I think, out of 32 cases in front of the Supreme Court, all very important New Deal era cases, became a justice, was very thwarted in his ambition to become Chief Justice, and among other things, decided to find other outlets, one of which was going to Nuremberg and becoming the chief prosecutor in the war crimes trial of Nazis in the immediate aftermath of World War II, something he did by just going. He didn't request a leave of absence from the Chief Justice. He just didn't show up at court, and he was gone for about a year.
It's nice to have life tenure.
It's amazing.
It's an amazing thing.
And so Jackson, you know, complicated figure in history, has gone down as a great justice. In fact, and his career was cut short because he died of a heart attack in 1954, in interesting circumstances, I would add.
Can you share them?
Yeah. Justice Jackson died of a heart attack in the apartment of his longtime secretary.
Oh, dear.
On a Sunday morning.
Oh.
The Supreme Court issued two contradictory public statements about the location and time of his death, and I had to do some serious detective work in tracking this down.
Uh-huh.
I think we can say with confidence, though, that he did die in the arms of a woman whom he loved.
And he was married at the time.
He was.
I see. To someone else, of course.
Yes.
Well, that's very interesting. I'd never realized that about Robert Jackson. I've always admired his writing.
He's a great writer, and many consider him, along with Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., as one of the two greatest writers in the history of the Supreme Court. And he's become a hugely influential justice in a way that was not obviously clear when he died. Mm-hmm. And then the last character is, in some ways, the biggest of them all. That was Justice William O. Douglas.
Mm. Wild Bill.
Wild Bill, a extraordinarily brilliant young law professor who became the highest paid professor of any subject in the United States when he was still in his late 20s. Mm. Young man in a hurry, went to Washington, didn't have close New Deal connections, started as a minor staffer on an investigative committee, and within a year and a half was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He became a protege of Roosevelt's, he was a protege of Joe Kennedy's, and actually Roosevelt seriously considered making him his vice presidential candidate in 1944.
And Douglas wanted to be president, didn't he?
Badly.
Uh-huh.
Once he was bitten by the bug, it never quite went away. And some of his great opinions over the next decade were driven by rhetoric that his colleagues thought, and sometimes even indirectly said, was an attempt to run for office rather than an attempt to be a justice. But Douglas, when he finally realized he wasn't going to be president, developed a really important jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And the two elements that I think were most significant were the deep belief in autonomy, freedom of the individual. Mm-hmm. He's the most deeply individualistic person ever to have been a Supreme Court justice, the biggest believer in individual liberties, mm-hmm. and in the idea that the government should leave you alone, coupled with the idea of a living constitution which should evolve, and should evolve in the way to make sure that individual autonomy was protected. And so, you know, today when the Supreme Court announces, for example, something like the right to gay marriage and frames its justification in the language of autonomy and the individual's capacity to make decisions for himself or herself, that's a legacy of Douglas. Same for reproductive rights.
Griswold versus Connecticut.
Absolutely.
And he also taught us all a word, penumbra.
Yes, that is true. An unfamous, a word that's famous but not always liked.
Right.
So if you like the idea of a Supreme Court that maximizes our individual liberties and autonomies, Douglas is your guy. If you hate the idea of an activist Supreme Court that just makes up rights out of thin air, Douglas is your enemy, and he should be seen that way. Last but not least, the great thing about these four people is they began as friends and they ended as bitter enemies.
And that's where the title of your book comes from. And I think that was the part that probably was the most fun to read about, was just how much these guys hated each other.
Yeah, someone said at the time that they were all on the court that the Supreme Court is 9 scorpions in a bottle. And so I try to tell that story. And to me, what was fascinating about it is that I actually think, and I argue in the book, that their greatness as justices was enhanced by how much they hated each other. So you might think of this as sort of the opposite of the old team of rivals idea, according mm-hmm. to which, we disagree with each other, but we kind of make each other stronger in some way of collegiality. This is not about that. This is about 9 people who genuinely couldn't get along, and 4 of them who genuinely came to hate each other. And day in and day out, they had to face each other and explain their interpretations of the Constitution. And so they developed their influential and deep theories of the Constitution in part because they couldn't stand each other. And I think that actually made us a greater country.
They forced each other to explain themselves.
They did, in the most intense and harsh terms you could imagine.
Right. Indeed they did. Well, that was another great book, and I'm sure that's still available on Amazon.
Absolutely.
And in local bookstores. And your current book is called?
3 Lives of James Madison, Genius, Partisan, President.
By Noah Feldman, with, I'm sure, significant assist from Jamin Feldman. I thank both of you gentlemen for being with us here today. This is the first father-son interview I've ever done, and I predict great things for your offspring.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The presidency is a tall task that is almost exclusively performed by tall figures. James Madison, however, is one of the few exceptions to the rule. Measuring in at a meager 5 feet 4 inches, He holds the unenviable title of being the shortest president in American history. Throughout his life, Madison's body never weighed more than 100 pounds and was beset by seizures, described by one of his contemporaries as a constitutional liability to sudden attacks, somewhat resembling epilepsy. His diminutive stature even threatened to derail his love life, as he stood a whole head shorter than Dolly when he first met and began courting her. Despite these disadvantages, Madison managed to graduate Princeton in 2 years, get elected to 2 federal branches of government, marry arguably the most beloved woman in the country, and serve 2 presidential terms. If nothing else, Madison's illustrious life serves as direct proof that brains indeed trump brawn. I'm Matt Dara, speaking to you from the Putter Studios at Montpelier with the Madison Minute.
That's our show. Thanks so very much to our 2 guests, Noah Feldman, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at the Harvard Law School, and his 12-year-old son, Jamin, who did a great job of disagreeing with his dad on some very important historical points. I thought kids were supposed to wait till they were 13 or so before they started disagreeing. Oh, well, he's a prodigy. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Matt Dara does our Madison Minute on behalf of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. Oh, and hey, by the way, if you like the show, listen to us online. We've got a podcast. Just Google Your Weekly Constitutional. That's Your Weekly Constitutional. And our podcast site is one of the first things that'll come up. We're also on iTunes and on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.